If you're listening to this right now and you're in the cold weather or you live in an area that is experiencing maybe a harsh winter, wondering how your hydration strategies are going, are you thinking about your hydration? What about your gear and the bottles you put your hydration in? How is it going for you? Maybe you need a few tips and reminders or a few learning points to get hydration back on your radar. You're in the right place. If this is ringing any bells with you, we've got Colette Vartanian from Scratch Labs joining us today for an amazing conversation about hydration and winter months, cold weather, talking about hyperhydration, and also getting a few updates on some Scratch Lab products coming out soon. Join us for this episode today. Welcome to the Inside Sports Nutrition podcast, your source for all things sports nutrition related. This show is hosted by myself, Dina Griffin, and my co-host, Bob Sibahar. We're both registered dietitians, board certified specialists in sports dietetics with combined professional experience exceeding 40 years. Our job here, translating nutrition and sports science research to give you real life strategies, awesome interviews with a variety of experts so that you can enhance your knowledge to optimize your health, fitness, and athletic performance. So grateful today to have Colette on our show, returning actually for a second round with us. Colette is the athlete care manager for Scratch Lab. She wears a lot of hats for the company, but today she is shining light, as I mentioned, on winter months and hydration tips, tactics, strategies. So we're glad you're here to listen in and get some pointers. Before getting to the show, wanted to mention that I've got a new health and vitality Nourish Circle program for women 40 and older starting soon here in mid-February. This program is to help those of you dealing with the effects of peri and postmenopause symptoms and the changes that the body experiences, but also if you're wanting to prevent diseases such as cardiovascular disease, Alzheimer's, perhaps slowing the aging process, looking at how your nutrition and lifestyle habits support that, this is the program for you. We've got combined live and online education, coaching, and modules, and the program's hosted by myself and my awesome colleague, Kristen Wolf, who's a licensed professional counselor and nationally board-certified health and wellness coach. So this is a very unique program with one-on-one support included. You're going to want to register for this program by February 6th. To take advantage of the early bird pricing, head over to nutritionmechanic.com under the services link. You'll find all of the info. All right, listeners, thanks for being here. And now let's get to episode 114. All right, well, don't know about you, Bob, but this past weekend we had some pretty chilly, snowy, windy weather here in northern Colorado, and my outdoor activities were quite exhilarating, and I'm guessing a little underhydrated. How about you?
Yes, I would echo that and say mine were extremely without hydration because I kind of went on spur of the moment a little bit longer than I had planned, and I knew I would pay for it. But you know what? Sometimes you've got to try things, right? It is. Yes. I mean, I was out there in below sub temps, and I know you were too, and you know, trying out some new gear and equipment. Unfortunately, the gear and equipment that did not make it in my backpack was hydration, and I knew better. But yes. Listen, I was only planning on going for like an hour, and that kind of ended up being about 3 hours. So that's my bad.
Well, luckily today we have our returning guest, Colette Vartanian, the athlete care manager, registered dietitian, sport dietitian from Scratch Labs. And I remember, Colette, when you were on with us last year in the summer of 2023, episode 80, you left us with amazing advice, which was for all of us to think about planning and preparing and being proactive, especially with hydration. And so it was kind of a fun, like bittersweet thing to be in these winter cold months and realize, oh, wow, I took that for granted a little bit, and feeling it just in a short period of time, that impact of poor planning, under hydration in the cold winter months when it feels like, geez, I don't even want to drink cold water or any kind of cold beverage. But I think you're going to turn on our thinking caps and other ways for us to really think about hydration in the winter. All of that to say, Colette, welcome back to our show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me again. I'm excited. We talked about warm weather, so let's talk about the cold now.
The cold. I wondered, yeah, just starting us off, Colette, maybe some things that us athletes, any kind of athlete that's out there in colder weather, snow, sub-freezing temps. I mean, it seems like a lot of us just don't, quote unquote, we don't feel like hydrating. We're just not having maybe a heightened sense of thirst anyway. But what are some of the things, thinking of strategies and tips and gotchas that you find are really important for this time of year for those of us in the cold weather?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of different kinds of cold weather sports, and some are year-round cold weather sports like ice hockey, figure skating, stuff like that, where you're indoors, but you're always cold. And then you have, you know, the sports that we enjoy in the winter outdoors, from skiing and snowboarding to ski-mo kind of stuff, or backpacking out in the cold and all that. There's so many kinds. I really didn't realize how many cold weather sports, anything is possible in the snow. You just add more clothing on and do it even harder. So I think that understanding what your sport demands is like the first thing that most people have to understand. Are you doing a sport that you can, you have access to water or food? Do you have to bring that all with you? Will you have stops along the way to be able to refuel, rehydrate? So the first thing is really understanding the sport that you're doing and the limitations that it might bring. Running in the summer is very different than running in the winter. Access to water becomes very different for a lot of people. And I mean, I do have a lot of athletes who are, you know, going out and skiing, and they will drink snow water that they've boiled, but you have to bring that stuff with you. So you have to really think about what materials and extra gear you're going to need for the cold weather, what your typical habits are and how they might change. And then just understanding your sport a little better and understanding what the demands are, because you may be burning a lot more energy, even though it doesn't seem like it, in colder weather than in warmer weather. So that's kind of the first things I have people pay attention to. And then understanding our basic physiology of what happens during cold weather. There's a lot of like, oh, I don't feel thirsty, or I don't sweat that much in the cold. Obviously, you're not going to tell if you're sweating that much, especially with the gear that has been made in the most recent years. Everything wicks so well, you don't notice sweat. You're staying a lot warmer, but you're not noticing that you are sweating or losing a lot of fluid. So I think that's also like really important to understand. And I guess walking through the physiology, what we know is that when you are in cold weather, your blood vessels start to like clamp down. They are trying to preserve as much heat as they can. And we even shiver to increase our metabolic rate. We are trying to find ways to produce heat in our body. And so if you're at sub-freezing temperatures, you're at cold temperatures for a long time, that blood flow changes a lot compared to when we're in hot temperatures, where our core body temperature is just changing a lot more quickly. We create extra heat, we create sweat, and that movement really does make a difference, but we don't notice it as much. It's not dripping down our legs or in our eyes like it is in the summertime. So we're not thinking about that stuff. On top of it, if you're living in a cold weather climate, that's really dry, like Colorado, I think people forget that respiration also allows us to lose moisture. And so with respiration, you have to think about if it's dry climate, you're going to lose a lot more fluid because you are trying to balance out from the dry air that you're breathing in. If it's more humid climate, it's a whole different story. You may not be losing as much fluid. So those are things also to pay attention to, because we are going to be losing more fluid in ways other than just sweat.
That's such an important point that you bring up. It's like more than just what we feel, either from a thirst sense or understanding the impact of our environment and that respiratory effect, just like you're human and you're breathing, and now we're in a dry, so like breathing, losing water in essence, and now we're in this drier climate, which poses some other variables that we don't either feel per se, or it's just impacting our physiology and that ability to stay hydrated or maybe dehydrate more slowly. Or on the flip side, it's rapidly dehydrating. So thank you for bringing that up. Colette, that just reminded me of something people feel sometimes or notice is like, oh, I feel like I have to pee more frequently when I'm in the cold. Can you explain a little bit of that?
Yeah. I get this a lot from athletes where they'll be like, I don't want to feel like I need to pee every 5 seconds when I'm out there, especially wearing all the layers. You don't want to unlayer every time you have to go to the bathroom. And so a lot of my athletes ask me, like, why do I feel this way? Well, again, physiology, our bodies are really smart in figuring out how to keep us warm, because we basically turn on our sympathetic nervous system, our fight or flight response. And that allows us to feel the urge to pee a little bit more. It causes stress, and that can, you know, lead to us having to pee a little bit more. And that is a really normal response. I tell a lot of people, like, unless you feel like you have to pee your pants, you can kind of push through that cold pee feeling. And it works for some people, and some people, we, you know, have to make some adjustments to their training just to be able to tolerate that cold. For a lot of my athletes, if it happens way too often, they're like, I'm just going to train indoors. That's fine. You find what works best for you. Everyone's nervous system will respond very differently as far as like the small nuances when you're in cold weather. Some people can truly tolerate it more than others, the same way that some people can tolerate heat a lot better than others can.
Okay. Yeah. I'm wondering for those, when you're mentioning thinking about access to fluids, so I'm thinking of those out on the slopes. You know, maybe they're not downhill, but they're out backcountry, or like they're self-sufficient. You know, they've got their backpack and all their gear with them, and they're kind of in remote areas. Gosh. And then like the water freezing, or like your the vessels that carry fluids. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts there? I mean, definitely fluid. And maybe that is like eating snow. I know there's some myths around like you shouldn't eat snow because that it's your core temperature cold. So maybe you could touch on a couple things there for those scenarios.
So working with a bunch of different athletes of different disciplines, I've learned a lot of different strategies for carrying food and hydration, because everyone in every sport kind of does it a little bit differently. If you're doing something like skiing or snowboarding at a mountain, it's a lot easier than when you are doing like kind of the backcountry kind of stuff, or cross country even, where you are more reliant on what you carry on your own. I've seen two different systems. Some people like the hydration packs with the tubes that they can put in their mouths. And some people like the Nalgene or the double wall insulated bottle, usually with a sleeve on top of it over it if it's sub-zero temperatures. I find that the bottle with the sleeves and the double walls and stuff tend to work better when you're in really, really cold temps where there's more risk for freezing. The packs and the tubing, there are brands that make insulated ones now, and there's so many different ways to insulate your pack. They still have a higher risk of freezing, especially in colder temperatures that are like what we've been facing this weekend. I read somewhere that we had colder temperature in Denver than in Antarctica this yesterday. So we are getting to freezing temps. And so your tube might freeze. I don't know if either of you guys have ever experienced that or have anything to share on that part, but that's the two systems that I see most commonly. And we try to figure out ways to just keep that stuff warm, whether it's wrapped in stuff in your backpack to keep it even warmer. Some of my athletes have like put hand warmers and stuff around their bottles when it comes to really freezing temps. With the air tubes, I've heard of people, they say there's less likeliness of it freezing if you blow air back into it after every time you finish drinking. There's some little tips and tricks, but I don't know if you guys have heard anything else on top of it, on top of the stuff I shared.
I mean, it's similar even from personal experience. Yeah, it's like trying to keep the vessel as warm or the bottle as warm, like on my body, or the blowback of the fluids into the, through the straw or whatever, back into the bottle. Yeah. But yeah, it's definitely, it's, and it is cool to see some of the technology with the insulation or the different kind of materials being used. Try and keep in mind lightweight and everything. Bob, did you have anything to add?
Yeah, you know, I think it depends on the temperature. Like we're talking about cold weather. And, you know, as we're referencing in Denver this past weekend in Colorado, we've been in the, you know, single digits below zero temps. But, you know, I think there's, for different locations and temperatures, there are different strategies, right? So our listeners in Florida right now are like, are you kidding me? Like 50 degrees, the 40 degrees for them is like freezing temperatures for them. So maybe a camelback, you know, with a hose would actually work in that situation. So like in my mind, we have to determine when it's below freezing or above freezing, like 32 degrees Fahrenheit, right? So, cause that's when I'm telling my athletes, okay, where are you going to be? Are you going to be in the Arctic or Antarctica? Or are you going to be in Florida? Or are you going to be in, you know, Australia in the wintertime? So I do think like that helps them choose whatever hydration flask or material that they're going to use, which I think is huge, right? So you talk about analogy in the summertime, but analogy in the winter is going to freeze in some areas, right? But no, I think it does depend. I think it's, the great thing is we do have technology. I do want to throw this out there because I've just had so many athletes bring like normal bike bottles with them in their winter escapades. It doesn't work, guys. Guys and girls, just please don't do that. Save that for the summer. Those little nozzles will freeze immediately. And if you think about that, we're out in the winter escapades having fun and we don't want to drink anyway. And now we have a frozen bottle, right? What are we going to do? So I guess what we're going to do is we're going to eat snow, right, Colette? But let's go. Why don't we just segue into the whole, you know, I don't want to call it myths, but they are kind of myths, right? And maybe we call them updates in hydration, myths in hydration. Like let's just launch in with the whole, should we eat snow?
Not if it's yellow.
Yeah, not yellow.
Go ahead,
sure.
Or brown.
I mean, I have athletes who are using water from snow, but they're boiling it to make sure that there's no contaminants, or sometimes even filtering it through their normal filters that they use for when they're filling creek water and all of that. So you still want to be careful because you just don't know what's out there and what's been on the snow, and also just what your stomach can tolerate, especially if you're someone with a more sensitive GI. I would make sure you're boiling and filtering that water if you're going to consume it. Yes, if you're in a life or death situation, eat the snow. Yeah. But for most of us, you just don't need to be carrying water if you're doing these longer, really long endurance things like ski hut trips and stuff like that, or ski mowing, where you're going to be kind of doing a lot more, bringing more gear with you. But I think it kind of goes back to, you're only as good as your gear in the winter. And so you have to be prepared.
So here's another thing. And I love that because I think a lot of people say, yeah, because I grew up eating snow and you're always eating snow, like clean white snow.
Yeah.
But you know, to Dina, to your point earlier, does it drop the core temperature? And I don't think we really need to get into that, but what I love what you brought up, because a lot of people don't think about what are the contaminants that could be in that snow, right? Was there wildlife? Is there something under it? Is like something passes, and that will throw off your entire day or trip or whatever. Like the last thing you want to do is kind of stuck in winter conditions with a bad GI system, not able to eat, not able to drink, nothing on you whatsoever. So that's also another good segue to another question I get quite a bit is, should someone bring, okay, so we talked about the vessels of carrying hydration, whether it's a pack, whether it's a bottle, where it's Nalgene, Hydro Flask, Double Wall, whatever it is. Should they bring hot water or cold water?
Yeah, this is a debate. This has been a debate for years. Physicists are still debating this, but from what I Googled after me and my coworkers went down a rabbit hole on this, was that it's called the Impemba effect. There's a name for this phenomenon, and it was like discovered in the 60s where they put hot water and cold water in a freezer to kind of see which one would freeze faster. From what they've observed, typically it is colder water that is going to stay warm or like not freeze as quickly. You're going to see hot water drop in temperature a lot faster. I'm not a physicist, so I don't really know like the chemistry behind why this phenomenon happens, but they say that hot liquids tend to freeze faster. And that doesn't mean that you shouldn't bring hot temperature drinks, because we now have insulated bottles. Like this was done in a lab where they were putting them probably in glass or plastic beakers. We said, don't bring your plastic bike bottles for, winter outdoor adventures. But we think about it and we're like, okay, we have insulated double wall stainless steel bottles now that keep things pretty warm. You also have to think about how long are you going to be out there? If you're going to only be out there for an hour or two, it's not going to freeze that quick unless it's not insulated. So bringing warmer fluids is never a bad thing. Okay, if it gets cold, it's going to get cold anyways. Freezing is a different story when it comes to like below freezing temperatures, and there's a lot more that we kind of have to think about there. But for most people who are training in freezing or above freezing temperatures, bring the hot liquid with you. It's totally fine.
That makes sense. Yeah, just trying to stave off like what's the worst that's going to happen and just trying to work from there.
Really, I think it comes truly from what I was reading. Hot water evaporates faster. Where it's happening. So I'm always curious, did someone go back and do a study where they put it in a container that seals? Because then you're not losing evaporation water. True. And so could it freeze slower? So all these things in my mind, my scientist mind goes, can we experiment with this a little bit? And I probably should have experimented this weekend.
Colette, let me ask you a question. Hypothetically speaking, let's say an athlete goes above the Arctic Circle and they're doing this event and they're going to be out in literally 10 to 20 degree, well, 10 to 15 degree below zero Fahrenheit, by the way, for 6 to 8 hours. And they have to carry all of their fluids and they really want to use scratch products also.
Yeah.
Should they mix hydration, scratch hydration with cold water or hot water, and or should they use super high carb scratch product in hot or cold water in their double walled thermos Hydro Flask? It's so cozy and it's a little sleeping bag in the backpack, whatever you want to say.
Yeah, I would say for those temperatures, one thing I will note is that your electrolyte loss doesn't change no matter what temperatures you're in. The rate in how much sweat you're losing or fluid you're losing is changing. So if you know that a mix of, 6 to 1,000 milligrams of sodium per liter is what works for you or whatever, you have the perfect amount of scoops that you've figured out and dialed in for summer, you can still use the same amount in your winter escapades. You're just going to drink less. So you have to be a little bit more aware of that. And maybe if you're someone who loses a lot of salt, maybe adding a little bit more because you're going to be drinking a little bit less. But I just feel like that what is in your bottle doesn't really change. It's how much of it you're going to be drinking that changes. You can drink scratch warm. You can drink the high carb warm as well. It doesn't denature anything. I usually mix those two together because it's easier, especially when it comes to winter sports, to grab one thing and do one thing rather than to be doing a bunch of different things, because the time that it takes to stop, you don't want to be stopping for that long. So I will say you can mix those things together, and fueling becomes a lot harder in those colder temperatures too, because your food tends to get really hard and harder to chew. So then chewing becomes annoying, especially if you're out there for 6 to 8 hours. At some point, your jaw is going to be fatigued. You're going to be working out your jaw probably more than your body. So keeping food close to your body is always a big one. Finding foods that don't freeze or are still palatable while frozen, or get harder when frozen, is kind of important to think about. But I do think liquids can be the easiest way. Warming them up, putting them in your insulated bottles. Some people prefer cold beverages, even in the cold. So it's really based off of preference, but you want to make sure your electrolytes are matching what you've always pretty much done throughout the year, maybe a little bit more. I always, for stuff like this, really focus on the pre to the event, because if you start really well fueled and really well hydrated, there's just less chance for things to go wrong. And if you miss a feed or your bottle freezes, you're covered just a little bit more than if you just kind of went in there without a plan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of takes us to another area here. Thinking of the hyperhydration, doing purposeful, maybe it's, you know, additional fluid and electrolyte or sodium specifically. And I don't know if we want to keep it in the winter sport or just kind of expanding this for like maybe some other updates in the science or from things you've been doing in the work that you do.
Yeah.
Pre-hydration versus hyperhydration, whether it's cold or not.
Yeah. So there's, I guess that's a really interesting thing, like the way you distinctly mentioned pre-hydration versus hyperhydration, because I truly do think that there's a difference. People who pre-hydrate are people who are just drinking fluids before a training session, before a race, whatever it is. They're just drinking their fluids. They drink their bottle of water, or they have their coffee and their tea. They're just drinking fluid. They're just like, I'm paying attention to drinking fluids. I don't really care about what's in it. When you are hyperhydrating, it's a specific protocol. The way that we typically do it is that we try to match the sodium content to what is in most people's blood. And so that is a really high salinity. It's pretty much what you would find in an IV bag. It's about 3,000, 3,500 milligrams of sodium per liter. And so that allows for really rapid hydration that we've seen in literature to improve sport performance. So if you are someone who is a cold weather athlete that is racing, this could potentially, depending on the person, improve performance. And so there is a method and a protocol to hyperhydration, and there's been many different protocols that have kind of come out. What we've seen that works the best, at least for our runners and our cyclists, has always been a higher amount of carbohydrates. So like somewhere between 60 to 90. Usually my sweet spot is about 75, depending on the size of the athlete, with about 1600 milligrams of sodium in that bottle. That equates up to about 3500 milligrams per liter. And so we'll put something like that into a bottle and have an athlete drink it about 15 to 20 minutes before they start. You don't want it too far out, because then it leads to needing to use the restroom. And sometimes also it can lead to some GI distress that can be alleviated once you start moving your body. And so we've seen this to work. Literature, there was just a review done by someone to kind of walk through all the different hyperhydration studies, because it hasn't really been really reevaluated since about 2007. So there's a lot we don't know. There's a lot that needs to be looked at in the future, even for females who are hyperhydrating, depending on their menstrual cycle, depending on the sport that they're doing, and the other GI, if they struggle with GI issues beforehand of even doing hyperhydration. But we see it work. And hyperhydrating for cold weather can be very effective, because it allows you to be more optimally hydrated leading into something. So you're not super stressed about, do I need to pull out my bottle right now? Or, you know, for a race, sometimes it's not as advantageous to always be pulling out your bottle or pulling out your food. So can you hack it so that you can do it a little bit more efficiently?
That makes sense.
It's a tricky, like, I think hyperhydrating is a tricky, it's a tricky science, but it's a tricky art in real life because one, and Dean, I'm sure you concur with this too. A lot of athletes don't really know what that is, right? They know hydrating, even pre-hydrating, they kind of know, but hyperhydrating before they, it's not well known. So I love that we're kind of bringing this up and, you know, I've got a devised protocol. I'm sure Dina, you've got a devised protocol. We're trying to keep up with the latest research, but here's the thing. One, I want two things. I want to make sure listeners understand what you said, because it's so important. We don't have data on every single category of person. So females, older males, younger females. Like it's all over the board. So I like where you guys are kind of starting. The second thing, can you just say one more time for our listeners? Cause I know they're fumbling. They're like, what did she say about carbs and sodium again? And they're going to replay this, but where would you have like a novice athlete, whether they're a winter sport or summer sport athlete, where would you recommend they start, which will not disrupt their, I mean, we don't know if it's going to disrupt their system, but disrupt their planning too much. What's the easiest way to start in terms of carbohydrate and sodium in a beverage to hyperhydrate? Is it the 75-1500, like you said, or is it something else for like the very basic?
I would say you need at least 30 grams of carbs, I feel like, prior to an event to make sure that you've really made sure that you have all your glycogen stores ready to go. That's a really minimal place to start to just make sure that it doesn't cause any GI upset. I feel like 30 is very manageable for most people. And then you work your way up. Salinity wise, I would say I would keep it on the higher end. You would want something over 1,000 milligrams. Mm-hmm. Otherwise you're not hyperhydrating. You are just matching what's in your sweat. And so you do need a higher amount of sodium. You want to practice this in training before you take it out to a race. And I think that you can work yourself to a good amount. Most of my athletes, at least in the elite category who've trained their guts, they don't have problems with experimenting on a race day with slight changes in salinity and carbohydrates. But for most recreational athletes, I do think you need a little bit of experimenting and figuring out what symptoms do you like and not like. Are you doing it with a good amount of timing? Also to consider, you shouldn't be hyperhydrating before you warm up. Hyperhydrating in the cold, if you're completely at a cold temperature and you haven't warmed up at all and your body is not warmed up, will just run right through you because your body's in that sympathetic response. So you need to be doing this after warm up or immediately at the start of a race. You shouldn't be doing this like 30 minutes before and just sitting around and letting your body cool down. There is a little bit of that. And that's why I think it's really great to work with a practitioner to kind of get into this deeper level, but also hearing it and experimenting on your own is also okay, as long as you're aware that you may need to find a bathroom if it's not sitting well for you. Mm-hmm. And you may also need water, like just plain water, if it's becoming too concentrated for you and you're feeling uncomfortable with the amount of salt that is in your system. And some people really truly feel it. So having some things on the side to alleviate the poor symptoms, which I will say that from the research, they're saying that a large amount of athletes do report some kind of distress from hyperhydrating, but the performance benefits outweigh the distress that they're feeling. And some of the distress may be future diarrhea, a little bit of bloating, nausea. Our athletes that are on the elite category can sometimes push through that stuff. But if you're a recreational athlete, pay attention and just listen to your body and make the best decision based off of what's going to work for you.
I wonder if those GI distress markers and symptoms are based on the mode of sodium that is being introduced. So you know, we've got capsules, we've got powders, we've got fluids, we've got little liquids, little sources. Like, is there, have you seen in the research, is there one or the other that's better or one that you recommend?
I typically like sodium citrate the most as far as GI tolerance and palatability. But in the literature, I haven't looked back at the studies from the systematic review to just see what types of sodium were they ingesting, because they were also looking at glycerol, which is a very controversial ingredient in hyperhydrating and in even Olympic sports, because it was banned for a little while for performance enhancing. So I need to do a deeper dive, and it'd be super fascinating. Hopefully maybe we can get a blog out on Scratch about this stuff, because I do think it's something that people are super interested in and understanding more. But I do think that the mode can matter. The type of sodium can matter, I believe. And I do think that the way that you ingest it can make a difference for some people, especially if you have a harder time with your GI system. You may need to look at some different avenues on how to ingest your hydration.
Definitely speaks to practicing in advance. Yeah. So you kind of can figure that out too, let alone some best practices. I wondered, Colette, just thinking of morning hydration or pre-exercise hydration status, what are your thoughts on whether athletes need to go so far as to use urine-specific gravity or pee sticks to kind of monitor what's happening maybe from a more objective perspective versus just relying on thirst or urine color in the morning? What do you think of that?
Yeah. So there's been a lot of investigation on urine-specific gravity, and honestly, the best hydration protocols in testing acute hydration. There's a lot of thoughts on it. There's different ways. Some are very invasive. Some are non-invasive. I would say that the urine-specific gravity or the pee sticks tend to be the least invasive and the most cost-allowing testing method, especially if you're someone who trains regularly and you're paying attention to it. But what I've really learned is that it's not a great variable by itself, because there's so many things that can affect your urine-specific gravity. I still don't think it's a bad tool to pay attention to. I tell a lot of my athletes, pay attention to the color of your urine. You don't even need to buy the pee sticks, but looking at the color of your urine first thing in the morning can be very telling of how you are doing. So a darker pee color will always or most likely mean that you did not drink enough fluids and you may have had maybe too many electrolytes. I kind of say one or the and or the other, or sometimes both, but you kind of want to look back at what you did yesterday and really take an examination and be like, did I have a lot of electrolytes? Did I have really salty food, or did I just not drink enough fluid? And then very light colored pee, so clear or, you know, light yellow usually means that you've had a good amount of hydration, or sometimes too much if it's clear, and that you may want to introduce some electrolytes in. So that's an easy way for a lot of people to look at it. Urine specific gravity first thing in the morning is a lot more accurate than if you're doing it as a spot test throughout the day, because food, hydration, time of day, body mass, all of those things can kind of play a role in that value. And also I've learned that your age can also affect that value. So there may be different baseline guidelines for a child versus and an elderly person, rather than just, you know, our average 20 to 50 year old. So I would say that it can be a useful tool, especially if you're trying to understand yourself and experiment on yourself. I would say that you don't need to be investing a lot of time and energy into it. Things like thirst on top of urine-specific gravity can tell us more. So if you're pairing both of those together, so taking a look at your USG or the color of your pee, and also taking an observation on your thirst level can tell you a little bit more. What I've learned more in the hydration space and the testing space is that more testing methods put together tend to tell us more than if you just do one by itself. So that can be a little bit more helpful. There's so many testing methods now, but I just think looking at the color in the morning, that's enough probably for most people to build better habits.
So
we don't have any way to test perfectly yet.
I don't think we ever will.
Unless we can understand the fluid shifts between intracellular to extracellular.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that technology will happen in our lifetime. I don't think we'll be able to.
Colette, before we transition into our high five questions, can you catch us up into what's going on at Scratch Labs? So what's anything new from when we talked to you last summer? Any new products, anything on the horizon?
Yeah. So sadly, in the last, month or two, and maybe some listeners have noticed, but we have been slowly discontinuing some products that just have not been performing well or just are not fan favorites, in lieu of just us trying to find better products out there or better flavors, better formulations. There's some stuff that got discontinued, like our crispy rice cakes, that I don't think are going to be gone forever. I just think that the formulation was not right, and maybe people were not, the price point maybe was not right, or whatever it is. There's just some reason that it just was not doing as hot as we wanted it to. But the great thing is you can still eat fresh rice cake. So that's totally fine. We still have a solution out there. But we are going to be launching a new product in the next month and a half. There will be more information on it soon, but it is a hydration product that will be a completely new product in our lineup. So I'm really excited to share more about that when it comes out, but keep your eyes out. Early March is projected launch date, and it'll be something to kind of add to our lineup. We are discontinuing our wellness and our hyper. And I believe those communications have already gone out. So sorry to my marketing team if I'm like speaking ahead of what's happening. But if you do love those products, stock up on them. But we are introducing a product that will bridge the gap and cover those products. So we're really excited about that. I think in the world of science and research at Scratch, Alan and I have been doing a lot of work with a lot of different athletes, getting them ready for the Olympics and a lot of other different escapades that they're, exploring. And so we're trying to, stay on top of the hydration research and the hydration testing, but also excited about a bunch of other stuff that is coming along on our lab side of Scratch Labs, and also the cafe. If you live in Boulder or visiting Boulder, I think that it's such a great place to meet other like-minded athletes, eat some really great food. You never know who you're going to find in there. I know you were there the other day, Dina.
I was.
I really truly feel like that's become our third place of where you can go as an athlete to meet other people or just be around other athletes and eat performance foods. So that's been really fun. So that's amazing. Kind of really what we've been working on at Scratch. We're hoping to do some more evening events at Scratch with some great speakers and potentially even do sweat testing at the office there or at the cafe there for our customers. So there's a lot of fun stuff that we might be doing pretty soon, but the new product is what I'm truly excited about and will allow for a lot of flexibility for our athletes and personalization, which I think is the future of sports nutrition.
That's wonderful. We'll definitely stay on in the news and subscribe, everybody. Subscribe mm-hmm. to Scratch Labs newsletter for updates too. And the Instagram account is amazing.
Yeah.
It sounds super exciting. Colette, yeah, the kind of work you're doing, very meaningful as well. So
yeah, I feel very fulfilled, and it's very important to feel that way. I love what I do, and I love the people I get to meet and work with, especially my other practitioners. You guys are all so great.
Awesome. Oh my gosh. Well, I know we could keep going with all of the hydration bits and pieces here, but if it's okay with you, we're going to transition to our high five questions, similar to what we did with you last time, just so the listeners can learn some more fun facts about you and us too, for that matter. Colette, I have to know, number one here, do you take cold showers or do cold plunges?
not regularly. I am a weenie when it comes to the cold.
I don't know if it's weenie or just like, that's not, useful. Or
I just know myself.
I love it. Okay, Paulette, number two, have you had your own personal sweat sodium concentration measured? And if so, what was it?
Yeah, I have. I am pretty average, which sometimes is not the best thing to say about someone, but I am pretty average. I'm around 850 milligrams per liter.
Okay. Yeah, that is in that moderate category. Mm-hmm. All right. I think I'm 941, just a smidge higher.
Yeah.
Something around there. Ooh, cool. Okay. Number three, Colette, what is your favorite hot beverage to drink on a cold wintry day?
Favorite hot beverage is always going to be a Persian tea. I'm Persian Armenian. And so a black tea with some cardamom and stuff like that, just plain. Sometimes I'll add, a little bit of sugar here and there if I'm feeling it, but plain black Persian tea. That's my go-to.
Amazing. That sounds delicious as well.
It's so good.
Oh, good.
I drink like 3 or 4 cups a day.
Colette, I'm going to take over the rest of the questions because I think Bob's internet's a little spotty. So number four, this is a fun question. Do you have a book or a movie that you could read over and over or watch over and over?
I have a favorite TV show or two series that I watch probably religiously if I'm not watching something new. First one is The Sopranos.
Uh-huh.
And the second one is Entourage. They are both HBO series, so you can tell like where my mind goes, but I just think that they're both great series, so they're always on in the background. I'm not a book repeater, though.
Okay.
I love reading books. I probably read 2 or 3 books a day. Don't repeat, ever.
Nice. Yeah, there's too many books out there. Okay, Colette. Well, question number five, our last one here. What's one thing about hydration that you wish all athletes knew?
That it's not as difficult as people make it out to be, and that being consistent with your hydration is so much more effective than trying to do all these fancy different things. And so finding what works for you and being consistent is much better than trying to, really overly hack it.
That's beautiful. And yeah, it kind of goes with previous advice from you, planning and preparing, but also this consistency piece. Mm-hmm. And yeah, thank you for that. Wow, Colette. Well, gosh, we have so appreciated your wisdom, sharing your expertise and tips with us. We'll be sure to put your contact info in the show notes, along with a few of the other things that you mentioned for the listeners.
Great.
Greatly appreciate you. And we truly do hope that you could join us again for another round of Hydration Talk. Would be awesome.
Absolutely. Thank you guys so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to get to talk to you guys. And I hope everyone stays warm out there.
Yes, we will try our best. And listeners, thank you so much for being with all of us today. We will catch you on the next episode. All right. Hopefully you got a lot out of that conversation with Colette, and hydration is new on your mind, or at least back on your mind, the importance of it. If you're in cold weather, winter months right now, hey, share the show with a friend, training partner, your coach, someone you know. If you can tag us on Instagram, ISN Podcast, and share this episode, the exposure, the visibility, sharing it, it really does help our podcast grow and be able to share future content with other listeners around the world like you. And we greatly appreciate that. Drop us a note over via email to hello@insidesportsnutrition.com if you've got a question. And stay tuned for next week's episode. We are discussing nutrition and some other pointers for those of us who are in perhaps northern hemispheres or areas where there might not be a lot of light exposure. Perhaps you are dealing with some seasonal affective disorder. We want to give you a couple tips around that to navigate this difficult time. If you'd like to learn more about our individual nutrition coaching and testing services and other programs. You can reach out to Bob over on his company website, energyperformance.com, energyperformance.com, or myself, Dina, and team over at nutritionmechanic.com. Appreciate you reaching out and being with us as always. The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the hosts and the guests involved and do not represent a replacement for medical consultation with your doctor. The information and opinions provided here are not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease or medical condition. This podcast is for information, education, and entertainment purposes only.